Welcome to the More We Know podcast with your host and social media influencer, Mir. Gen Zs and millennials need information now. That is why Mir is bringing in experts from all around the world. Because the more we know, the more we learn, and the more we earn. Here is your host now. Enjoy.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome back to the More We Know podcast. My name is Mir, your host. The More We Know podcast is a top 10% mentorship podcast focused on helping you Gen Zs with mentorship from around the world. The reason it was launched is effectively a lot of people don't have access to mentorship, so we've democratized the access to mentorship by giving you access to a mentor in your pocket, literally from wherever you are, whether you're on the way to work, whether you're going to school, in college, whatever it might be. We provide you some of the top people every single month to mentor you in your pocket. We've brought on people like the mayor of Miami, the founder of Reebok, and just people from different industries. And today I'm really excited about our next guest. Our next guest is Bushra Amiwala, who has gone down in the Chicago History Museum as the youngest Muslim elected official in the U.S. So she is the youngest Muslim official elected in the U.S. She's been on the cover of Time magazine. She's been on many major news outlets. She's been in a lot of the fashion magazines you know about. She also works in technology at Google. She has a multitude of experience. She's a Gen Z like myself. This podcast is focused on Gen Zs, and I'm really excited to dive into her experience on politics and becoming the youngest official and working in big tech like Google and, you know, sort of that journey and that fusion. So thanks so much for coming on today.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here today.
Yeah, it's really exciting. I've been in this podcast side of it now for going on 2 years, and I don't have the opportunity to talk politics much. So being able to transition and get into that is something really cool. And so, you know, you're the youngest elected official. You know, how old are you now?
I'm 24 now.
Okay. So you're 24 now, and walk me through that journey. Like, were you always into politics? Like, walk me through a little bit about your childhood.
Yeah, that's a great question. So growing up, I think a lot of what you want to be when you're younger is reflected by what you see presented on TV and books and movies, things of that sort. So growing up, I was obsessed with Disney. I was obsessed with reading. And the only time I saw someone who looked like me was Princess Jasmine. So I was like, I just want to be whatever she does. Yeah. But really what boiled down to what I liked about her was positionality, grace, authority, and leadership. She, you know, she was a princess of a kingdom. And I think we see sort of one side of it, but what was drawn to me about her was she looked like me and had these positive traits. I also, growing up, wanted to be a lawyer and knew that that side of the house is something that definitely interested me and compelled me, and I was drawn to it. But as I grew older, I explored law and realized perhaps it's not for me. And I'm the first person in my entire extended family to be born in the United States. For context, my dad has 12 brothers and sisters. Therefore, to be the first born in this country from all of that, there was an ongoing joke in my family that I could be president one day if I wanted to. And that was the extent of like interest in the political realm and sphere. Outside of that, I was super interested in nonprofit work and things of that sort and giving back to the community. And it ties back to my dad's story in some way too. So I feel like politics was maybe deep down always in the cards for me, but it's so hard to imagine yourself in a space where there isn't someone who looks like you represented there.
Yeah, and where did your parents grow up?
My parents were both born and raised in Karachi, Pakistan, and moved here at different points in their lives.
Okay, and so when they came here, you know, what sort of industries did they go into?
Yeah, so I always say my story is incomplete without sharing my dad's story first. So my father came to the United States from Pakistan in the 80s with $20 in his pocket and an abundance of dreams. He worked extremely hard to make ends meet and worked every job from bussing tables to flipping burgers to delivering pizzas to driving a taxi to later owning his own clothing store on the west side of Chicago called Chicago Style. And both of my parents now, you know, I feel like are the epitome of middle class and making it into this realm. But for them to see me emerge into this field, that's the true story of what the American dream entails for them and for me in some way too. So neither of them ever had interest in politics. I think politics, especially back in Pakistan and other different countries, can be seen as a bit more divisive and not as inclusionary as it is sometimes in other areas. So for them, it was so far-fetched to see their daughter go down this path.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think, you know, we grew up in similar cultures. I came from Jordan, the Middle East. My parents were born there and they came here, and went on to be successful in their careers, but our cultures tend to push you towards this lawyer path, this doctor path. And traditionally, in the cultural sense, if you don't go down one of those two paths or engineering, you're sort of not going down the right path. So to for you to come in and kind of take that path you did initially, although in many lenses is, you know, the coolest thing ever to do because you made history, you know, in some traditional paths, they can say, hey, why didn't you go the medical route? Did that ever play any impact in your relationship with your parents, or were they very supportive of it?
Yeah. So when the idea came up to run for public office, I sat both my parents down. I was 18 years old at the time. And I asked them for permission. I was like, hey, do you think I can run for office? And my dad was elated. He was over the moon. He was so excited. Wow. He's like, absolutely. And my mom said, no.
Wow.
She was like, no way you yeah. are going to do that. No chance. Yeah. And you know, I think growing up in a culture where we respect our parents in a way where their opinion really matters, you don't see that as like, oh, asking for permission. You see it as asking for their opinion. And her opinion was, no, that really swayed me in some way. But I was pretty invested in that this is something I was set out and wanted to do. And a week after I told my mom that I'm going to run for public office, news came out that there was a judge who was found dead in a river. And it was almost justifying that maybe this space isn't for people that look like her and me. And it was a long time coming, but as I, you know, went on with my campaign, my mom became the person that would deliver lunches to all of my volunteers. And she would hand out literature to people that would come to vote on the day of election as well. And she convinced so many of her friends to vote who historically did not even pay attention to the political realm and fear. So she became my ambassador, but it definitely did not happen overnight.
Yeah, well, that's amazing, because I feel like, especially when you're 18, we discount the impact our parents have on our lives, because, you know, if we have close relationships with our parents, we really want to be able to have them support us, but also get this sort of acceptance from them. So the fact that you ended up getting your mother's support is really cool. But, you know, this whole idea of politics, a lot of people listening are Gen Z like us. And, you know, it might not make sense to a lot of people. Like, I kind of want to break down this whole idea of you getting to the youngest elected official, because that's something remarkable. But I know why you started, but, you know, how did you start it? Like, what if someone listening right now wants to become the next youngest elected official in their category, what's the process of getting into politics?
That's a great question. I think the best way to break into the political realm and sphere is to work for someone who was running for office first. That's what I did. So it's all started from, you know, December 2015 to summer of 2016. I was a senior in high school at the time, and I took this AP Government and Politics class, and I took it with a lot of friends, and it was our homework assignment to go watch Fox News and see the Republican candidates debated out to see who their Republican nominee would be. And after our homework assignment, I remember coming back to class and a lot of my friends saying that they would vote for Donald Trump to be president, which was news to me, because at that time, especially, he was spewing the most harsh and hateful Islamophobic rhetoric, which I felt was so pointed at someone that looked like me that I couldn't fathom that a friend of mine would want to support someone like that. That being said, I realized I maybe did not fully understand what the issues and causes were that people from the Republican Party cared about. So I wanted to get a firsthand look of what it meant to be Republican. And I knew I wanted to work for someone who was Republican, just to get a firsthand look of what that meant, even though those maybe not where my values stood. But I didn't want to work for just any Republican. I wanted to work for the most powerful Republican in the state of Illinois. And I didn't know who that was at the time. I Googled it. It was our U.S. Senator, Senator Mark Kirk. We only have two senators per state. One of them was this man. And I applied to be his head field intern, meaning my job would be to go door to door to various registered Republican voters' homes and ask them a series of five questions. And later the team would take the answers to those questions and write policy around it. Example is, you ask a group of people, do you like chocolate ice cream or vanilla ice cream? Everyone says chocolate. Strawberry's not an option because democracy is not totally fair. And you say, I like chocolate ice cream too, right? It's your way of representing your constituency. So on that campaign, I just have to ask questions. And the questions are in my app. I press start on the app and I show up to the first house. The first question on that list was, on a scale of 1 to 10, how fearsome are you of an Islamic terror attack on U.S. soil?
Wow.
And that was the first question I had to ask. Wearing a hijab in a hot summer day, t-shirt that says Mark Kirk, And that wasn't even the most surprising part. The surprising part was what came after, which was the person standing at the front door saying, 10. Very fearsome. And me standing on their front porch wasn't helping. And this was 3 miles north from my home in Glenview, Illinois. News to me. Yeah. And, you know, working on that campaign gave me the tools necessary to even consider why it was necessary for someone like me to emerge in this field. And, you know, I went back to the campaign office that day and I asked some of my fellow intern friends, I was like, guys, like, why do we keep getting this answer to this question? To the point where I inserted question number 1.5, which was why? Because when else will I have the opportunity to talk to someone who not only disagrees with me, but is scared of me? And the responses I would get was, well, you're the first Muslim person I've ever met, which maybe was not true, but maybe it was the first visibly looking Muslim sure. person that someone met. Point being, my fellow intern said, find me an example of a Muslim doing something good in the media. This was in 2016.
Your fellow interns?
Yep. And this was in 2016. And perhaps the question wasn't said as tactfully, yet the sentiment I understood.
Yeah.
And I said, challenge accepted.
Yeah.
Sure, I'll find you an example of a Muslim doing something good in the media. Surprise, surprise, it was kind of hard. Because every time a Muslim was presented in the media, they were either the victims of violence or the perpetrators of violence. And any time a Muslim was presented as a hero, they were brought down 10 notches before they could rise 5. And that's what I saw over and over again. And little did I know when I would run for public office myself, that's what the media would try to do to me.
Wow. I mean, it's crazy because it brings a little bit of flashbacks for when my parents came here. We came in 1997, right, as I was born, and they were getting into the medical field. And of course, as 2001 came about, being Middle Eastern, you know, the number one question is, it didn't matter about your credentials at that point. It was more like, you know, are you related to these attacks? Like, what's going on here? Like, we don't want people like you guys in this space. So for you to like see that firsthand, it's crazy because it looks like a lot of times in life, we start chasing things when we realize that there's like this need for a change. Like your passion sort of meets like, oh my gosh, I have to make a change. Like, were you almost demotivated while doing that campaign to say like, well, shoot, I don't even want to be involved in this? Or did it push you to that next level to be like, I have to do this?
That's a great question. I think that's what the inflection point was for me.
Sure.
It was like, this is why it is necessary. And it was actually someone on that campaign that saw leadership ability and potential in me that I definitely did not see in myself at the time. Prior to working on that campaign, I was at 5 different nonprofits the 5 days of the week as a volunteer. And someone on that campaign pulled me aside and said, you should run for public office. And that's the question we need to be asking each other way more frequently. Because that question allowed me to see what I couldn't earlier within my own self. And I took that question quite seriously because that interest that came with that question wasn't, oh, no, I shouldn't do it. But it was things such as, but how is it hard? Like, am I old enough? It was those types of like logical questions to ground myself in whether this was practical or not. And people would say, yeah, you have to be 18 to run. That's the youngest age. For Congress, it's 25. So I'm not old enough for that yet. But for a local office, it's 18. That's how old you have to be to vote. And it blew my mind. And I was like, wow. And you know, it goes back to that saying, give me the confidence of a, you know, mediocre person per se that sometimes people have. I wish I had seen that in myself sooner though.
Yeah. And you mentioned an interesting point there, which is wishing you had seen that sooner. So a lot of times when we're chasing that next step in our life, especially like for Gen Z's listening, this is a mentorship point here. It's easy to look at someone that's accomplished something and say, hey, I want to take the same steps that it took. Like if I look at your Google, you know, shirt there and you work for Google, if you look at the CEO of Google, you can see the founder, where he came from, how he came from internationally to come here and build and scale Google with his co-founders. But it's easier for a Gen Z to say, hey, look, I have that foundation to say, hey, I can maybe do something like this because they've done it and I can learn from their steps, and success generally leaves clues. You, however, were entering not only a space that's already confusing, like it's, you know, even the research that I've done, and I consider myself an educated person to some extent. And so, you know, politics is a tricky, slippery slope, and there's a lot of things that go into it. And especially Illinois, there's a lot of interesting things in politics. So you not only had to deal with that, but now you're going towards something that's never been done, which is at the time you were going to become the youngest Muslim elected official. Who were your mentors then at that point to help you get to that if you haven't seen that before?
It's a great question. You know, my journey with mentorship was very interesting because I longed for mentors. Sure. I was thirsty for mentors. I was like, yes, like come to me. And I realized early on that, you know, I was looking for people that looked like me, and it was hard to find them existing in the spaces I was in, but they didn't have to be another Muslim politician to be my mentor. They could have just been an educator, you know, who's just as connected or something like that, and still provide me the guidance necessary. I had micro mentors along the way. I never had a prolonged mentor who saw my journey from end to end, but I had micro mentors who stepped in for a significant purpose and then saw their way out. Because the people I would turn to when I had my first media interview, I turned to someone who, you know, has done these types of interviews before, and the advice that I got perhaps was not as relevant to me at the time. And now I look back and say, hey, repeat the question when someone asks you something in a TV interview. Here's what a soundbite is. Things like that I couldn't even comprehend. And with micro mentors, you might get advice that is way higher than what you can actually grasp and comprehend. And that's what I was up against. And the second thing that I think is interesting is that women of color have historically been pitted against one another because patriarchy has made it so there's only one seat at the table for someone that looks like one of us. By virtue of that, there has been competition more than collaboration. And I found that I was being mentored by some people up into a point of jealousy. Because now I wasn't a mentee, suddenly I'm in the same category and I'm a threat. So I feel like I found it really hard to grasp onto a mentor. And I've seen so many other people run for public office after as a result of me doing so, because my story was showing that it's possible for someone that looks like us. And I've seen two versions of it. I've seen people that have gone and run themselves and forged their own path and sort of see my playbook as to what to do, what not to do. And I've seen someone who's used my talk track and tried to tell the same story I would tell, but it's my story and no one wants another version of someone else. They want the only version of you. So I think there's a really fine line between looking at others who have come before you for guidance versus being someone that mimics a story just by virtue of, this is the playbook and this worked for this person, so it'll work for me.
Yeah. I think what you mentioned there is an interesting case study, because if you look at someone like Trump, initially when he was running, I think, you know, any logical person was like, wait, what? Trump is running? Like, this doesn't make sense. He came from business. There's all this shady practices. He ends up winning. You know, politics aside, one thing you can give him from a marketing standpoint is he knew how to differentiate himself and give himself attention, right? That's away from politics, away from what he's done. But he knew how to keep attention on him that, like, you were forced to talk about him. We'd all be in a room and we'd be talking about Trump. News, everyone was talking about Trump. So he found a way to differentiate himself. And so it goes back to your point. You know, if you're telling the same story as others, it sort of impacts that. And, you know, you have to have a bit of not only just being authentic, but also something that separates your story. So what did you feel like was your initial separation point at that point when you were like 18 years old getting ready to do this?
My separation point was my dad's story. You know, people would find that super fascinating. They would say, what do you mean your dad sold eggs at the age of 3 or 4 to help make ends meet for his family? Like, that story of him growing up extremely impoverished and then moving to the States and forging his path on that way. I tell people that's what keeps me grounded today. I mean, obviously a humble person doesn't describe themselves with like humility, but there are some points and validity behind being able to claim that when some, maybe others in certain spaces cannot. Politics is an extremely narcissistic driven space because you're forced to talk about yourself and position yourself against other extremely intelligent and qualified and smart, brilliant people. And you have to be, well, this is why I'm better. And another thing, people loved to talk about what I looked like when I was running. So this was in 2017, 2018, when I ran for office the first time. And what's interesting about that is that people hadn't seen someone like me in this space before. So the media was hyper-focused on what I looked like. And that distracted from my messaging, that distracted from my platform. I had this means-based property taxation model that was pertinent to the Cook County Board at the time. That was unheard of. And people still, political commentators talk about this today, that if I, you know, didn't allow the media to talk about my appearance as much, I would have had higher chances of getting elected the first time. But to put the onus back on me for something like that, I felt like that was so beyond my control, though.
Yeah, Yeah, no, 100% it is. It's just, it's especially your age too, and you know, not having the same experience some of these people have that are 30. So, okay, now you make that decision to run. You had this motivation from that situation, which I think that's such a, like, I would go back and rewind that because I love that. Like, you had sort of this chip on your shoulder fuel from seeing, you know, blatantly as helping the strongest Republican. What was going on, and you know, the fact that people were saying that to you just a couple miles from your house, it's crazy. And at your age too, at 18, you can't discount that. But what was that next step process like? The day you decide to run, what is the process of getting in?
Great question. I tell people it is so easy to run for office. It's hard to win mm-hmm. when you're running for office, but it is incredibly easy to run. To run, you need a couple things. You need, depending on what seat you're running for, anywhere from 50 to 1,000 petition signatures, which should be from an eligible voter in your district. So for context, when I was running for the Cook County Board of Commissioners, I needed about 350 signatures. I collected about 1,500, three times the amount. The second office I ran for, the Board of Education in Skokie, I needed 50 signatures, 50. Mm-hmm. That's it. Wow. And I say that to really boil down how obscene and far-fetched and things that this may look like. And now I remember trying to Google how to run for office back in 2017, 2018. I found nothing. Mm-hmm. And now when you Google how to run for office, you find a NPR Life Kit podcast that I guess yeah. I happen to be in as well, right? Yeah. And you have these systems and structures, which excites me so much because we're lifting the third veil from these processes that historically have been made confusing on purpose. So a certain type of person is not interested and or able to find themselves in these spaces.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, now it's crazy. You didn't have that information back then when you were running. So Skokie, 50 votes. How many did you get?
Signatures. I got like 250.
250?
And I was like, well, that was easy.
Yeah. And then what was the process of getting your first vote? Like, were you going door to door? Were you just talking to your friends and family? Like, what was that process?
Yeah. So just for context, I ran for public office twice. I ran the first time when I was 19 and I lost my first election. I ran against someone who had been in office for 16 years. And he was about 70 years old, and I was 19 running against him at the time. And there, I mean, Cook County politics, like you mentioned it earlier, there was a third person in our race who was, people say, was put into that race to pull votes from me, a 30-year-old gay Jewish man. He would take votes from the 19-year-old Muslim girl, right? You're both young. You're both representing different demographic backgrounds. You're not pulling from the incumbent, the person who's like 70 years old, has been there for a while. And apart from things like that, I still got 13,500 votes in that race. Mm-hmm. Came in second, ended up losing. And you know, on election day, there was a reporter that came up to me, mic in my face, as I'm crying. I cried on election night. And he goes, "Will you run for office again?" And I was like, no. And, you know, someone saw that news segment that day who really felt some type of way, who was like, oh, she's not going to run again. And they called me first thing the next morning, 7 a.m. I mean, I used to not wake up at 7 a.m. I still sometimes struggle to wake up that early. And they're like, you have to run for public office again. You registered thousands of people to vote. Historical voter turnout in our race because you ran. Like, why would you not, like, do it again? And I will support you this time. Just don't run against me.
Mm.
And it was my opponent, the, you know, 70-year-old incumbent who had been there for 16 years. And with his support, I decided to do it again 6 months later and ran for office again.
Just not against him?
Just not against him. Ran for a different seat and did it 6 months later. And there were seven people in that race. And I won by 47 votes.
Wow.
Which shows every vote does matter. When people have kind of like that cynicism behind, well, my one vote won't make a difference, I literally won by 47 votes because there were seven people in that race.
Wow. Wow. So to go from, I'm just trying to take that all in, the first time you lose, you're kind of, what was the feeling like when you lost? Like, did you feel just demotivated? Did you feel broken? Like, describe your emotions.
Oh, I was a terrible feeling because failure is one thing. Mm-hmm. A public failure is another. Because now you're getting pity from people. Yeah. Everyone was watching. You feel like you've let people down. I had a team of 250 to 300 volunteers. I felt like all of them were crushed. And people who had never paid attention, I was almost the beacon of hope. But then I lost. Yeah. And I was like, now it's like, damn, like, did you all lose that too? And then I think, again, I mentioned I cried, but I share that so openly because I think people think that, you know, those who are in politics have to be a certain way. And I really try to be, and you mentioned this word earlier, authentic with my leadership style. I try to be genuine. I try to be someone who is the real when it comes to that stuff. And it felt terrible. But I think what made it worse is that I felt like the world was watching and I disappointed more than just myself.
And I think, look, that's an important lesson for people listening overall, because so many times in life we're going to fail and it's going to happen again to both of us here and, you know, just in life. And, you know, unfortunately this generation now, what I've found, because I work with Gen Zs, the podcast, all the listeners are Gen Zs. I think Instagram and social media has gave us this makeup, if you will. Like, we see what's going on in front. Like, you're not going to post a picture or a story of a bad time. Like, you generally want to post something that's good, which is why I call it the makeup. And as a result, we've gone into this comparison trap. And I say comparison is the thief of joy. And, you know, we fall into things like depression and demotivation. So for people listening in, especially these 20 to 25 year olds, you know, they might have just got a bad grade in college and something they might have studied really hard for. They might have to retake a class. They might have been denied from 5 or 10 interviews. They might have just graduated college and they might not have a job. Or they might just not know what they want to do. And they see these people that have millions of dollars or millions of followers or politics or whatever it might be. So what advice can you give people that are ambitious like you, but end up trying something and failing and, you know, losing, if you will, like that first time you did, since that happened to you?
Yeah. One of my favorite sayings that my dad used to say all the time is, you can build a foundation as you walk on it. Mm. So sometimes I think people who are ambitious, are driven, and especially in our generation, we are heavily fixated on having all the answers before we make that first step because it comes from a fear of failure. And you don't need to know what step number 10 is. If you're on step one and you know what step two is, that's what you should focus on for today. Then from 2 to 3, 3 to 4, it's easy to see the end vision of what step 10 looks like, but that's distracts from what you actually can do. And Gen Z, I've done a lot of research on Gen Z too, is the most creative generation than any other generation we have. And what's so fascinating about generations is generations have the most common attributes than any other demographic subsect. So you could put together a group of women, you could put together a group of Muslims, you could put together a group of Gen anything. And the generational attributes that people of that demographic share are more than the group of women and are more than the group of Muslims and are more of any minority faith group, religious group, ethnic background, which is why we are the most likely to DIY, to do it yourself. And the things that will work for us hasn't even been discovered yet. And it can and only will by us. So that would be my tidbit or piece of advice.
I really like that. My mentor always told me measured steps. So you can look at like, hey, I want to get this many votes or I want to lose this many pounds or, you know, get this much salary, but you have to take like a measured step toward that. So I like the idea of the foundation. So the process of running a second time where you won, you know, did you in the back of your mind have that first loss as you were running? Like, were you thinking about that a little bit or did you kind of just forget about it?
No, it's easy to put something like a loss, like to put it in a box and ignore it. But I integrated it and incorporated it into everything I did because now suddenly I know what I would have done differently. And I was given a second chance that I created for myself. But I was like, if I lose the second time, I'm a two-time loser. Can't be that. Don't want that. So that was almost a different type of motivation that came out of that. And the first time I ran for office, I focused on people who had not voted before. So now I'm convincing you to vote, and then I'm convincing you to vote for me. The second time, yes, I did that as well, but I focused more on the people who were already going to go vote, and then I told them to vote for me. Mm-hmm. So now I'm suddenly making one ask instead of two. And the people that saw me lose the first time, I mean, this might be a stretch, but I tell people I was kind of the Bernie Sanders of the Muslim community, right? Like people, everyone thought I was going to win because they only saw my side of the campaign. Everyone, it came from a place of optimism. A lot of people did not vote because they were like, oh, like Bushra, like she's got this. Like, I don't even know who the other person is. And it's because I was the only one engaging that community. But that optimism led for a lot of people to not turn out to vote, who prioritized voting the second time because they felt responsible for the loss. And I think that was really cool for me too.
And it goes back to the notion you said, like every vote does matter. Mm-hmm. I know sometimes we're like, hey, On the large scale for the presidential election, your vote doesn't matter, but you really start seeing on especially the smaller scale how important every single vote matters. Now, the process of finally winning, did you find anything interesting? Like, were there friends or family that didn't vote for you that, you know, flat outright told you no and didn't support you? Or did you have a really good support system overall?
You know, I feel like I had a really good support system overall, but they always say you never know who your enemies are, right? So I think there are people in everyone's life who perhaps might be people that you confide in and think you're close to, but you don't know if they have your best interest or not. And I really think that now that I'm older, I have this greater sense of emotional intelligence that makes me recognize that maybe the question that a friend is asking me, like, oh, do you really think you can win? Comes from a different place, right? So to me, intentionality is everything. What are your intentions? What are my intentions? And, you know, it reminds me of the faith of Islam, because it always says, you know, intention comes before everything. Before you start a prayer, before you do a good deed, like that is at the forefront of everything. And now I evaluate my personal relationships based on intentions too.
Yeah, intentions are huge. Now, other than the cost of time, is there a cost when running for office? Like, do you pay anything?
Oh, gosh. Huge cost. Yes. Which is really unfortunate. I can definitely walk through the cost. So when I first announced I was running for office, everyone would say, oh, my gosh, like, how much money are you going to raise? And I was like, why does everyone keep asking me that? I was like, what do I need this money for? Yeah. Everything from the staff that manages your campaign to the T-shirts that you have everyone wear to donations to come to be in the room that these people are at to network, all of that costs a ton of money. Sending out mail, running Facebook ads, all of that stuff in between costs a ton of money. And I definitely have aspirations to run for Congress one day. And people say that's a $1 to $2 million race to be a reputable, viable candidate. And for my first race, I raised about $80,000, which for me at 19 seemed really cool that I was able to do that. But I was also offered a ton of money from corporations that I declined because their messages weren't in line with my values. So just a quick story. When I was running for office the first time, one of the laws that the seat I was running for, that board passed, was the soda tax. Maybe you remember it. The penny per ounce tax on bottled sugary beverages. Mm-hmm. And I was against that tax, not because I'm like pro soda company, but because that money from the tax was not being invested back into the hospital systems where we're dealing with, for example, spiked blood sugar, you know, diabetes, things of that sort. It was like, where was this money going? It seemed like a stint to me. So I was against that tax. And, you know, one day I was invited to this really fancy restaurant, RL Restaurant. Never forget. I had no idea what RL Restaurant was. It's Ralph Lauren Restaurant. Can't confirm if the table, white tablecloths have the little logo on it, but I never got to go that far. And I'm sitting at this table with these two people who are ready to offer me, you know, $55,500, which is the maximum amount you can give legally to a candidate in the state of Illinois.
Why is that? Do you know? It's just the number they set.
It's just like the number, yeah. And I declined that money.
And right there and then at the restaurant?
It took 24 hours. Okay. And I declined that money because it was not in line with my values. Mm. And to this day, political commentators say that if I accepted that money, I would have won.
Because, that first time?
Mm-hmm. Because that money would have resulted in me being able to send out 3 pieces of mail to every registered voter's home in my district. And those are the choices you sometimes have to make. But that, people still talked about the fact that I declined that money. If I accepted, I would not have been able to sleep at night, right? I knew I would have been compromising my values. To what cost? I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess maybe losing,
yeah,
if you hear what others say. But lots of money goes into politics, unfortunately.
Yeah. But what's crazy is you, like, at the end of the day, you're the one that, you know, when you're home and you're not in front of anyone and it's just you versus you, you're able to look at yourself and say, I'm proud of what I did from an ethical perspective and, you know, being morally responsible. But it's, if you look at the political world and the landscape in general, and, you know, I'm not a big speculation person, but, like, if you just look at some of the things that have happened, like some of these politicians that have gone to jail, you look at the people we had in Illinois too, there's a, you know, the, what was his name? Blagojevich. And what people will do for money is sort of an element of craziness, even though, like, politics is supposed to be this, you know, not money focused. It's funny how, like, how much money actually is involved to get anywhere within that.
Yeah, I agree. And you know what's interesting too is that I'm in an unpaid elected office. Mm-hmm. Therefore, people say, like, you know, why do you work? Like, why do you do all this stuff? Like, you know, if you love what you do serving your community in this way, why don't you do that full time? I said, I don't get paid for it. Yeah. But other seats do pay. But I don't think, in my opinion, a living wage, mm-hmm, which is why they turn to ventures such as lobbyists and taking bribes and things, mm-hmm, of that sort.
So this is a mentorship podcast, so I try to educate them as much as possible. You said some of these roles do pay. For the roles that do pay, what are those roles different from yours? And the second part of that question, if you can, is, you know, it's not a livable wage. What are the salaries like, if you know, in those roles?
Yeah. So, for example, roles that pay are, honestly, my role is the only one left that is unpaid. Oh, everything, wow, else either has a small stipend or something. That stipend can be anywhere from $10,000 a year for most part-time positions. Two, in Cook County, the seat is also a part-time role, Cook County Board of Commissioners. That pays $80,000, which is a livable wage. But the full-time positions, such as state representative, state senator, those pay from $45,000 to $65,000 for a full-time elected role. In my opinion, if you're doing this full-time, $45,000, if you have a family of four that you're sustaining, I don't think is nearly as much. So again, it comes back to this, almost this barrier, financial barrier, between who has access to make it into this space, to break it into this space, and who does not. And it really, we should do some soul searching as to why we have the same type of person at every level elected, whether it be in our state or in our country. Maybe it comes back to money.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great point. And for your role, is it, so it's unpaid, is it full time?
It's part time.
It's part time?
Yeah.
Okay. And what's the, like, doing this role, what's the time commitment? What do you actually do in the role?
That's a great question. So the technical time commitment on paper is one meeting a month. I serve on three committees as well.
And what are the committees, the industry? It's like, what part of the political field is it?
Yeah, so I serve on the Board of Education. So it's, mm-hmm, one board meeting a month. But I also serve on the Equity Committee, the Finance Committee, and the Governance Committee. And each of those committees have a monthly meeting as well. And then right now is a strategic planning year, meaning we are putting together the five-year vision for our school district, and that has had weekly meetings that I've had to attend, which has been lovely. It's been a really nice way to engage with members of the community, but it is an additional time commitment that historically was not accounted for. And then any events that you choose to go to, it's not a part of the job description, but being on the board, I want to go see the school play,
yeah,
right? I want to go to Fun Fair and Fun Fest, back to school bash, things like that. So whatever time it takes to go to, yeah, those types of events.
Yeah. And then from an exposure standpoint, how often do you interact with, like, the governor of Illinois or Mayor Lightfoot?
Yeah, from an exposure standpoint, it's interesting. Most people who are on the Board of Education would not interact with those folks at other levels. But I'm lucky enough where, you know, just this past last month of October, I saw the governor four times, and I have a picture with him each time too, right? And the lieutenant governor, Juliana Stratton, she came and spoke at the iftar I hosted for 400 people in April. So I'm lucky that I've sustained and nurtured a strong relationship with these folks, but otherwise we are at the top of the school system. Therefore, there's no reason for us to engage with anyone outside of ourselves and our board of seven, because we are the end all be all decision makers.
Yeah, that's amazing. And your work leaves an impact, which is really cool. Mm-hmm. You're coming up on a re-election here, right?
Yes, I am.
Walk me through that process.
Yes. So it's been 4 years. I was like, wow, I just got here. Yeah. But 2023 will mark a full 4 years. So I'm running for re-election now. So same thing, 50 signatures, nothing crazy. And we'll collect obviously more just to be safe. And then, you know, it's talking to people in the community, ensuring I'm being an accurate representation and reflection and voice on this board. We will find out on December 12th what the opponent scene looks like. Mm-hmm. And apart from that, there's other things that I'm really excited and proud about that I've been able to do after being elected to this position that may not fall within my job description, but it's about being creative to make change.
Awesome. That's amazing. How different do you think the landscape is now? Because I see you're active on social media. You've been in documentaries, which I really need to ask you about. But now, do you think it's an easier, like, is it as easy as going on Instagram and saying, make sure you go vote or go vote for me? Like now the access to followers and people has changed.
I agree. I think the landscape has changed a ton. I also think politics are kind of trending now, which is exciting. Yeah. But it wasn't cool 5 years ago to run for office. Not at all. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a no-brainer to go vote the way that it is now. I definitely think, like I said, the first time I was running, I was convincing someone to vote and then saying, okay, vote for me as well. Whereas now the conversation, I think, isn't whether you go vote or not, who you vote for, which one, puts the power back in the people, which I'm grateful for. But two, I see, you know, some large corporations that might do a civic engagement campaign that weren't doing that years ago. So will it boost civic engagement? I think that this election was a testament that, yes, it has. But I hope it's not trendy where trends die. I hope it remains cool because we fought for the right to vote. We fought for the right to have representation and democracy in this country. Therefore, I've always said voting is cool, but I'm excited that it's mainstream media now thinks it is too.
Yeah, it's always a cool feeling being sort of the contrarian, where initially you're the one that's, you know, focused on it and it might not be as cool. And now it's becoming, you know, like you said, on TikTok, everywhere you go, it's politics and voting has become cool. Like even the way we invest now, ESG, and based on your values, like value driven is something that's becoming really popular for us Gen Zs. You're about to be 25 soon as well, right?
Yes.
So would you consider doing the full Congress run?
Yes, I would love to run for Congress. I definitely have aspirations to run for Congress. I, you know, think back to my younger self. I would love to run for President of the United States one day once I pass that age threshold too. I definitely have higher aspirations to run for political office.
That's amazing. Now, I see that you also work for Google. I'd like to understand a little bit about that process there, because I know you mentioned you don't get paid from the politics side. So Obviously you want to make money. How are you bridging the gap between having the political landscape but also working full-time at Google?
That's a great question. So I think we touched on this earlier when we talked about family and how it influences our careers and things of that sort. So I majored in management information systems in undergrad, and I had a double minor in community service studies and public policy studies. So I would jokingly say I majored in what my parents would want me to do and minored in what I wanted to do. Yeah. And I hope for a day where I'm able to do something like politics and service and things like that full time. But today I can't afford that. Mm. And I say that with my chest because a lot of people are either embarrassed of that fact and or choose to not enter this realm and sphere because of that fact. And there aren't enough people who put pen to paper on that. But I'm really grateful for the opportunity to be at Google. I've had internships prior to my time here, always in the business realm and sphere. And we talked about rejections earlier too. I was rejected from a couple different companies before I finally got my job at Google. Mm-hmm. And they always say a rejection is just a redirection. And that's something that's really stuck with me through that point too.
I love that. Rejection is just a redirection. Working at Google, is it restrictive in any sense being in big tech? Like, do you have to sort of walk on water with what you do on social media and politics? Is there, you know, conflicts of interest, or are they really like supportive of what you do?
I'm so lucky that I work at a place like Google, because honestly, they really celebrate the work that you do outside of work, no matter what it is. I think everyone I see at Google has either a side hustle or serves on a board for a nonprofit and or is fundraising for a cause they care about and or are running triathlons and marathons. But there's always something that people do beyond work. Yeah. And it's bringing your whole self to work. So I felt extremely supported and celebrated at this workplace. And I've been at other workplaces, you know, as an intern or what have you, where that wasn't the case, where I would have a slap on my wrist for saying like, hey, like this interview mentioned that you work at our company, you didn't ask us for permission. Whereas I've never had anything like that at Google come up. Wow. And it was just a simple sentence such as Bushra interns at this place. But I think it's a huge testament to the organization and the institution that Google is and serves for. And I could not be more grateful to be at this company.
And how long have you been with Google?
It's my first job out of college. So I've been here for 2 years and some change now.
Okay. Wow, that's amazing. You went to DePaul?
I did go to DePaul. Yes.
That's awesome. So Google, politics, DePaul, take it back a little bit. When I was doing some research on you initially, I saw you on, you know, different talk shows, like one of those Good Morning shows. I saw you were in documentaries. What were the documentaries you were in? And then on the second part of that question, you know, these shows that you were doing, was this right after you got elected that I saw you get just an influx of press?
I got a lot of press actually while running the first time.
Okay, gotcha.
And then I got another influx of press a year after I had been elected, which I thought was so interesting because it wasn't after I got elected, it was a year later it came. And here's another sort of tidbit I'll share with you all. I never had a PR firm or company help me. I realized that people will only find my story relevant if I'm talking about it. Therefore, I went to the press myself and told them my story. And I pitched myself to media outlets. And when I first ran for office, fashion press picked up on me. And, you know, I would hear things like, oh, you know, you're a diverse face who's easy on the eyes. And I was like, maybe I want to go into business press then. So I pitched myself to other types of press outlets because I wanted the full spectrum. But there are three documentaries about me. One is on Hulu, one is on PBS, one is on Amazon, and they're all different, done by different people, different companies, and they've all happened in different stages. So the PBS documentary followed me from my first election to my second election victory, and that follows Stacey Abrams from Georgia and Rashida Tlaib from Michigan as well, which I think is super cool that I'm one of the few. And the Amazon show is kind of like Queer Eye, where you have the five guys that transform your life, but it's the five women that change your campaign. So I was the pilot episode for that. It's called Wow. Run the Series. Yeah, it was really cool because it's kind of like unscripted reality TV. So that's what that was. And then the third documentary came out in 2021, produced by ABC, Disney, and Hulu, called Our America, Women Forward. And that was a International Women's History Month project that was done.
Wow. I mean, and you were on the cover of Time magazine?
Yeah, I was on the cover of Time magazine in January 2018.
How did that, like, how did they reach out to you? Like, what was that process?
Yeah, so in 2018, I think media was definitely kind of covering my story, so I was relevant and top of mind. Mm-hmm. And it covered, the feature of the magazine was called Avengers, like record number of women running for office for the first time. So it just so happened January 2018 was the beginning of the women's wave. Mm-hmm. And before that, I'd been running since 2017. I was able to ride the wave for 2-3 months and enjoy that. So since I had been doing it since 2017, I just got an email one day asking for the rights for my photo.
Wow. So Time magazine, all these documentaries, I mean, just so many cool things that you got to experience at such a young age, and you're still like not even halfway in your 20s. What are you thinking for the second half of your 20s? Like, what do you want to be able to accomplish?
That's a great question. So one of my favorite things that I've been doing for a long time is public speaking. Mm-hmm. And I definitely want to double down on that a bit more. I think I first started, was asked to speak in that capacity when I was 16 years old. I was a pretty overachiever in high school and stuff like that too. And was asked to public speak. And here I am 8 years later, and I can earn an income by speaking as well, which I think is super cool. And so definitely want to do more of that, maybe bigger platforms. I've spoken in front of crowds ranging from 25 to 15,000 people, which has been really cool in that way. I also am writing a book and hope for it to come out in the coming months, which I'm really excited about. But it's really interesting because there's this vulnerable point of when you're writing about yourself that you really want to be intentional about every word that you put in there. And then finally, I'm in graduate school right now as well, part-time. I'm getting my MBA at Northwestern.
Wow. How do you still find time to just balance?
I think when it comes to the question of balance, the calendar app is really helpful, which is the first thing. And the second thing is accountability. Because now if I have my workouts scheduled in my calendar, I'm not going to miss them. This is a priority that I've locked into my calendar. And if it's not in my calendar, consider it not happening unless it's officially in there. And that's the organizational tactic that works well for me. By virtue of that, I schedule hangouts, brunch on Saturday mornings, Friday evening dinner, things of that sort. I have to put them in my calendar, which is annoying for some people, but also they know that that's what it is for me to just stay organized and on top of everything. And that's what works for me. But then the final thing about balance is that this came up, used to come up a lot when I was running for office the first time. People would say, you know, you have all this exciting press, you are getting elected soon, you know, you have this great job lined up. Like, what did you compromise, right? Like, what did you give up on? And the honest answer is probably relationships. I do have friends. I have a million acquaintances, sure. But I don't know if I have the same types of relationships that I would have if I didn't go down this path. I think sometimes I question if people have my best interest at heart when they're close friends of mine. And that whole competition aspect we talked about earlier. And I don't know if these things would be normal things that I would be thinking about and having to consider if I did not put myself in these spaces.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm approaching my mid-20s and I'm, you know, single and stuff. So people also talk about that. Like, that's something that a lot of people my age, regardless of their background, are settling down in that aspect too. And I feel like those are the things that I perhaps robbed myself of.
Yeah. And, you know, in my opinion, I don't know if Rob would be the best example because you still, like, I feel like anyone who does any sort of greatness, you almost have to sign up and, you know, reaffirm with this belief of like having to sacrifice something. Like, there's no such thing as a free lunch wherever you go. And that's what I subscribe to. But, you know, this idea, I guess devil's advocate, you know, why have friends in your life in the first place that potentially you feel like might not even be there for the best interest? Because the way that I look at it is if someone's my like closest person in my life, whether it's a mentor or a friend, you'd almost like to prescribe to the notion that they do have your best interest. Like, it is almost unconditional.
I agree. I actually 100% agree with that. But I think leadership is really lonely. And that's maybe not talked about often enough. And by virtue of that, you might not be able to see through the sauce and the fog and be drawn to people for different purposes of comfort that historically you wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah. And I feel like in your position too, especially as you elevate, there's growing pains that come with the question of like, who's here for what reason? And it's tough. It is really lonely.
It is. It really is. And every time I get an exciting award or every time I'm invited to an exclusive event and the question is, who's your plus one? Like, that stresses me out. Like, my family's like exhausted with all of this stuff. Like, they are happy for me. They're there unconditionally. They love me, but they're not trying to go to another award ceremony. Yeah. And like things like that. Like, that's the stuff that I think honestly isn't talked about often enough in this space. And I share this only to give the full circle view of like, yes, this is the glitz and glam. Yes, this is what you'll see on my social media, but this is the real that I'll share with you in a one-on-one conversation too.
And that's what I love about having conversations like this, because it's so cool to see the accolades and the awards and what's amazing. And, you know, anyone looking in can look at that, but what is going on outside of it? The stuff you mentioned, not sure who has your best interest at heart or the doubts. Now, you know, being where you're at in terms of accomplishments, do you still suffer with any form of self-doubt? And the reason I ask that question is because so many people our age have so much self-doubt and sort of are so scared to talk about where they're at in life because they feel like they're inadequate. And I almost want to give them like a real genuine nature of the fact that even if you have accomplished a lot, there, you know, there's still time where you might feel like imposter syndrome or you might feel like you haven't accomplished enough.
I feel all the time, like every day. And it's because it's human nature to look at those above us, not below us. Mm. And it's a hard time to remember your roots and remember how far you or I or any of us have come. It's easy to forget that when you're so focused on the journey ahead of you and where you want to go. And I think that's why I enable imposter syndrome within me, because I'm like, yeah, but I'm not there yet. Forgetting where I am today and even seeing, you know, I've had like, I remember you asked me 5-6 years ago, who's the one person you would want to meet? I would say Barack Obama in a heartbeat. I had a 2-hour meeting with him a year ago, wow. Right? So I forget these things of like what truly it looks like to look forward, but remembering where you've come from backwards too.
A lot of gems right there that I think the audience will take away from, but I have to ask you, how'd you meet with Obama and what'd you guys talk about?
Yeah, so the Obama Foundation reached out because they wanted me to be an advisor on the building of his presidential center. So we talked about that. We talked about the education landscape in the Chicagoland area. We talked about ways to collaborate and partner together and to ensure that Chicago is an educational hub and the presidential center is utilized to its utmost efficiency.
Yeah, and that's so cool. And anything from your conversation with Barack that you took away that, you know, just from how he speaks or the way he thinks of things, anything interesting?
Yeah, I think his tenacity is something that is so obvious. And I think what's really nice about President Obama is that he can talk in everyday vernacular language, but he can also do the corporate speak, the political speak, and he can turn it on and off. But my favorite part was at the end of our meeting, his question was, how can I help you? What is your ask? And on this mentorship podcast, if you're a mentor to someone, and I talk about this oftentimes too, it's the art of asking for things. Mm. I've had networking conversations with people with not an ask at the end. And I now looking back, I'm like, wow, they're waiting for me to ask for them to refer me to something, to introduce me to someone. And it's almost seen as like a missed opportunity. Mm. And the fact that he integrates that into the closing of his conversation is something that I hope to emulate when people come to me and say, hey, can I pick your brain? Hey, can you help me with this or something like that?
I love that. I had one guest who founded this company called Three Wishes Cereal that you might see at like Whole Foods, and they've crushed it in the last 5 years, scaled to a huge multi-million dollar company. But I asked him, like, when you had to go raise money or you had to ask for advice from some of these high profile executives, you know, how do you find a balancing act for people our age that need something from them? And he said it's this act of polite persistence. And so it's the way you ask. And I've subscribed to that notion of polite persistence. So I really like that concept. Just even from, you know, President Barack Obama asking you that, it's pretty cool. Now, you mentioned you've met the governor. It sounds like you've met Mayor Lightfoot as well. You've met all these people. You continue to network with people, whether it's from Google or from politics or connecting people on podcasts or socials. How do you manage that network? Because networking is something that it's its own art. How are you able to not only manage a network, but actually then go in turn like what Obama had told you and, you know, actually leverage your network? Because some people either have a really good network, but don't know how to ask and leverage that network. And some people know how to ask and leverage, but don't have a network.
Yeah, that's a great question. I still struggle with managing my network. Every day I say, oh, I wish I made a Google sheet with every single business card I had, every single person I've met, put their name, email, phone number, affiliation. And the time it takes to start that, for me, I think it's harder now because I feel like I wouldn't even know where to start, but I wish I had done that for myself. My version of that is my LinkedIn. I add everyone I meet organically on LinkedIn, and you never know who will end up where. Yeah. And I, you know, everyone, I'm connected with random people who now like and comment on my posts, who I've had meeting with, who are now, for example, you know, the chief marketing officer at McDonald's corporate to the chief executive officer of OnlyFans. Yeah. And these are the people who are liking and commenting on my posts and who I could literally email and ask for a meeting and they would take out time to meet with me. But what do I have to ask for? I don't know yet. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's donations when I run for office in the future, right? Maybe it's advice for a specific niche topic. Maybe it's an introduction to someone else. But I am very intentional about when I choose to put that time on with someone. Because it's just a general conversation when you become super busy and people want to help people. They're like, whoa, this was just a chit chat. Like, you know, so and in my second TED Talk, I talk about the what I call the hustle mentality equation. And it's really fascinating about why people choose to not ask for things and the difference that asking for things can make.
Yeah, it's crazy. I find myself like even doing a podcast like this and what I do professionally is I'm exposed to so many different people, and I still find myself, because growing up in the culture that I grew up in is, you know, our parents never asked for anything. You mentioned your dad was selling eggs at four years old to get by. I mean, our cultures, it's very taboo to ask someone for something.
It is.
Like, so I had to get uncomfortable with even the podcast, asking someone for an hour of their time, especially the high profile people I'm dealing with. It's like, you know, how can you ask someone for that time? What helped me though is figuring out that not only am I asking them for something, but they're also getting something out of this too. They get to come on a platform, like shifting that energy. And I feel like a lot of our Gen Zs struggle to find that ask. And, you know, you and I are still struggling with it. It's a challenging thing to ask.
It is. And in my talk, I talked about to be clear, specific, and vulnerable and direct, but vulnerable in your ask is always key, because it's a way to tie back to why you're asking to begin with.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. And I love that. As we get closer to the conclusion here, I want to ask you something I ask every single guest is, you know, if you were giving a commencement speech today for the college kids that are just about to graduate, what is your sort of 45, 60 second commencement speech like from the experience you have to college kids graduating?
I've given a handful of commencement speeches before, but 60 seconds I haven't done. So mine would probably be, wow, this is great for 60 seconds. I would say that I grew up in a society where the only times I saw Muslims in the classroom was in reference to the Ottoman Empire or 9/11. Mm-hmm. Once I got elected to public office, I testified in front of the Illinois General Assembly to showcase the positive contributions of Muslim Americans in history. And this law passed. And now every public school in the state of Illinois has to teach the positive contributions of Muslim Americans in history and other minority faith groups too. So I always say, around you are the people who love you. Behind you are your memories. Before you are your hopes and dreams, and within you is all you need.
Wow. I love that. That's like beautiful for 60 seconds. And I could tell, you know, I see why you do public speaking, because there's a lot of gems there. That's amazing. Thank you for that advice. Now, you're getting into public speaking. You do a lot of that already. Is that something, do you think full-time with politics, would you eventually transition out of your full-time corporate job to do public speaking and books?
I would love that. And you know, inshallah, which means God willing, I hope one day that that's what's in the cards for me. And if not, then there's probably a better plan out there for me.
And by the time people are listening, we'll probably be closer to your book launch. Anything from like a social media perspective or where you're going to potentially be launching, you want to share with the people here? I'll put all the links in the descriptions, but where can people go sort of find you and find your books and, you know, when your books do come, inshallah, and booking you for public speaking, et cetera.
Yes. All the emails and direct messages that come in linked through my website or on my social media. I manage all my own social media. So follow me on Instagram to keep in touch. Send me a message for any request. I personally respond to everyone that messages me. It takes some time sometimes, but I still do respond. And that's something I take a lot of pride in, because I've sent a lot of cold messages to people without response. So it's grateful to be that person that does get back to folks.
That's amazing. I'll put all the links in the description below. Bushra, it's such a pleasure to have you come on as our mentor today, especially not only hearing your story that's actually made history, but also from a different perspective, which is coming from raw and authentic and sharing just the good, the bad, and the ugly that comes with sort of transitioning to the next part. And, you know, to be elected in the Chicago Museum as the youngest elected Muslim official at least gives me a testament to know that anyone in their lives listening now can make history. But the question is, you know, how do you want to make the history, and what step are you going to actually take forward? And I think you're living proof of actually executing on that by taking steps.
Thank you. Yeah, my last tidbit that I'll leave with everyone is, one, thank you so much for having me. I'm super honored to have been here. Time flew by, but what name will you make for yourself? Tell our listeners.
That was powerful. Thank you so much, Bushra. She is our next mentor on the More We Know podcast. I really appreciate you guys. Make sure you subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and YouTube, and we will see you with our next mentor. Thank you, Bushra.